Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Paul Cézanne sought to systematize the spontaneity of Impressionism and define an analytical way of seeing the world. His paintings express a new vocabulary of art and a new interpretation of the nature of visual experience, moving away from art as purely visual sensation and toward a more cerebral approach. Cézanne's belief that there are two things in the painter, the eye and the mind, each of them should aid the other, was taken to heart by the young Pablo Picasso. In 1943, Picasso declared that Paul Cézanne was my one and only master. Indeed, with the artistic achievement of Cézanne, modern art would chart a new and challenging course.
Welcome to the National Gallery. My name is David Gariff. I'm a senior lecturer here. What we've started this month to complement the exhibition is a series of slide overviews that I'm doing here in the auditorium. This does not take the place of going through the show. I'll show you things here that you won't see in the exhibition, and I can talk a little bit about context here in a different way. Many of you have probably already seen the exhibition. If not, I would encourage you to see it, and hopefully after we talk about some things, it'll be a much more meaningful and enjoyable experience for you. This is an exhibition about Cézanne's portraits, and for the most part in Cézanne's studies, his portraits have not received the amount of attention that other subjects have. We normally talk about his landscape paintings, his still life paintings, of course. Those two areas especially have been particularly explored. A few years ago, we did a huge exhibition here called Cézanne in Provence, and it was just about the works in Provence. This is a more focused exhibition, and it tries to sort of redress that imbalance in the scholarship. The portraits are interesting, but the one thing that is important in understanding Cézanne is that no matter what he was painting, still lifes, portraits, genre scenes, landscapes, there's a consistency in his working method and in his technique and in the way he approaches painting across all of the different subjects that he explores. So I want to mention briefly some of those techniques because they are important. They sort of define his art. They're not techniques necessarily that he invents, but he certainly does intensify their use. So the first is the use of a very heavy, especially early in his career, a very heavy impasto, which simply means he pushes a lot of paint around on the surface. So it's very thick, it's encrusted on the surface. It's very visible, very tactile. So that tactility, that sense of touch is very, very pronounced. That's an important. It gives his paintings a weight, both literally and figuratively, a certain gravitas. The second technique goes hand in hand with this heavy impasto, and that is if you have that much paint on the surface, it's very difficult at times to push it around with a brush. The brush just isn't strong enough, no matter what kind of bristle you use. So he develops a very sophisticated use of the palette knife. The palette knife looks like a tiny little trowel, metal, that artists use. Usually they use it to mix their paints on their palette. He uses it as a tool. So he pushes the paint around, which means he creates very often these kind of blocky, lozenge-like structural strokes on the surface. The third element sort of relates to these two as well, is what is simply called painting in reserve. And what painting in reserve refers to simply is that Cézanne doesn't always feel compelled to cover the entire surface of a painting. And very often, peeking through the paint, you'll see the bare canvas. So that's painting in reserve. You can see it sort of right there, for example. And very often, and when we have that kind of technique, which exposes bare canvas, of course, what it also exposes is the idea that this is a painting. This is on a flat surface. And of course, for the subsequent history of modern art, that's going to be a very important concept for artists to accept. And then the fourth idea, fourth technique, is that Cézanne tends to apply the paint in parallel strokes. So when you look at a Cézanne painting, more often than not, they are very structural and logical in the sense of the painting application, because you can actually see he laid this stroke down, and then this one next to it, and this one next to it, and this one next to it. And throughout the whole painting, there's this sense of a parallel brush stroke that helps to, again, create structure for the most part. It stresses process, because you sense this idea that this came after that, that kind of application of the paint. It tends to very often undercut preliminary drawing. There isn't much underpainting in Cézanne, like where he works out the idea in paint and then paints over that to finish the work, or even underdrawing. There isn't a lot of underdrawing in Cézanne, so he tends to work directly with the brush on the surface or with the palette knife, and so there's this, again, kind of individual structure feeling. Now, Cézanne is a giant, and I'm not sure what else we can say about Cézanne that hasn't already been said or written. He's one of the greatest painters in the Western tradition, has a huge impact on the subsequent development of modern art in the 20th century. He's tough, he's difficult, he's not easy to understand. So with Cézanne, you have to spend time, you have to be patient. More than most artists, he really does require time and close looking. So if you think you're gonna understand the Cézanne painting by just sort of blowing by it in the gallery, that's not gonna happen. You need to sit, and depending on the painting, sometimes 30, 40, 50 minutes is actually not excessive to actually begin to see him kind of deconstruct what he was constructing. Now, this difficulty and his ideas and when he emerges, of course, create a certain aura around Cézanne. And I'm showing you here an exhibition catalog and the poster for the exhibition from 1910. In November 1910, in London, the art historian, critic, essayist Roger Fry organized an exhibition that you see the title of right there, Manet and the Post-Impressionists. That's where the term post-impressionism is born. Roger Fry coined this term. And he coins it right here for this show in that catalog on that poster. There was no such term prior to this. And the artists who were in this exhibition included artists that today we don't think of as post-impressionists. Manet, we don't. And certainly not Matisse. Picasso was actually in this show. But these three, along with Georges Seurat, we consider to be the four sort of quintessential post-impressionists. And all Fry did with, or sort of the reason he came up with this term was because he looked at those artists, especially those four, and said, I don't know, what do these guys have in common? They don't have that much in common. So he said, well, the one thing I know, they all came after the Impressionists. So that is basically how the term was born. This exhibition in London was the very first time that this art was seen by an English public. And most British art critics, British public in general, they in 1910, they were still trying to get a handle on Impressionism. Monet and Renoir, Pizarro. And so there's a whole host of wonderful responses to this show. E.M. Forster wrote about the show because he attended it. And he said, quote, Gauguin and Van Gogh were too much for me. And then if you go through the critical response, reviews in newspapers, etc., you come across references to describe the exhibition that include words like horror, madness, infection, sickness of the mind, sickness of the soul, putrescence, pornography, anarchy, and evil. So Cézanne, Van Gogh, Gauguin, these beloved artists, that's how they were first sort of viewed. Not everybody felt that way. Virginia Woolf went to the exhibition, and she wrote in a letter to a friend that, quote, on or about December 1910, human character changed. She felt the exhibition actually changed the world, changed the nature of how we see human character and understand it. Fry followed up this exhibition with another post-impressionist exhibition 2 years later. And really, his writings are still read today, especially on Cézanne, because they're considered particularly prescient and particularly, of course, and they're beautifully written. This is Roger Fry here on the left, a photograph from 1913 by Alvin Langdon Coburn here on the left, and Augustus Charles Cooper's photograph of Fry on the right from 1918. Fry wrote the catalog for the show, and in the introduction he said, quote, "These artists say in effect to the Impressionists, you have explored nature in every direction and all honor to you, but your methods and principles have hindered artists from exploring and expressing that emotional significance which lies in things and is the most important subject matter in art." So he's saying the Impressionists saw things, but the post-Impressionists are going deeper. When Kenneth Clark wrote about Roger Fry, the historian Kenneth Clark, he considered that Fry's writings on, especially Cézanne, had the greatest influence on English taste since the writings by John Ruskin. So they were particularly important. This is a self-portrait that's in the exhibition. It's a small one here on the left from 1880-81. This is not in the show on the right. It's a landscape that's in our permanent collection, Houses in Provence from 1883. Fry went on to talk about Cézanne and wrote this, quote, "His work has the baffling, mysterious quality of the greatest originators in art. It has that supreme spontaneity, as though he had almost made himself the passive, half-conscious instrument of some directing power. So little seems implied at first sight in his apparently accidental collocation of form and color, so much reveals itself gradually to the fascinated gaze." So this idea, as I just mentioned, of having to sort of spend time with Cézanne to understand, things are revealed gradually. So here's a landscape, here's a portrait, self-portrait. But if you'll notice, the way he paints the dome of his, well, the whole painting, but especially the dome of his head here, are these beautiful parallel strokes. I mean, basically, if I were to cut this out and put it here, it would be the landscape, this terraced landscape of parallel brush strokes right here. This difficulty and this interest already in kind of blurring foreground, middle ground, background. This is where he's just taken the stick end of the brush and scraped away the paint. So that's showing canvas there to look like these vines here. This is a magnificent portrait. It's very small, but it shows you also within the sort of size. Size doesn't necessarily equate with power in Cézanne. He can pack a lot into a small space. Again, a nice comparison is to look at Cézanne compared to some of his slightly older colleagues. They weren't actually that much older. This is the self-portrait I just mentioned. This is Cézanne's portrait by Renoir. So this is Renoir's portrait of Cézanne, 1880. This is a pastel on paper. And it's beautiful, of course it's lovely, but it's very different. And you can already sense in Cézanne that what he's interested in is a kind of structural disassembly and reassembly of things. That's what fascinates him, certain relationships. This patterned wallpaper he uses repeatedly, it's actually a pattern that was in his apartment, in his house. There's just a whole different kind of sensibility at work here. So here is Cézanne, a photograph on the left from 1870, and on the right, an earlier photograph from 1861. As I sort of alluded to, sometimes Cézanne, because he is particularly difficult, precise, calculating, complex, he's often referred to as a painter's painter, which simply means, in some ways, you almost have to be a painter to fully appreciate what this guy was doing as a painter. So he's very rigorous, disciplined, focused, he's diligent, he's intense, he's difficult, he's curmudgeonly, he's cranky. He creates an art that's difficult, that's challenging, it's one that's fraught with implications for the later history of modern painting. And if I had to sort of simplify his contribution, I would say, and basically what it encompasses is that Cézanne moves away from an art that is purely visual sensation, and he moves to an art that is cerebral, conceptual, although that might be exaggerating it, but And where I think you see that is in this wonderful famous quote when Cézanne was asked about Monet, and they were close friends, and somebody said to Cézanne, so what do you think of Monet? And he said, ah, oh, Monet, he said, what an eye. And then he said, but he's just an eye. And that's both a compliment, what an eye. I mean, if you're looking for somebody who just has the ability optically to see light and color and the so-called, what Monet called the envelope between his eye and the thing, the space in between, Monet's your guy. But that's where he stops. And that's too bad. Because you have to go to the next step, which is to take what you see and translate it through your intellect, through your mind. So from the visual to the more conceptual. And for Cézanne, that is the struggle. And that struggle takes place in Cézanne's work, as it would be for any painter, on a flat surface, which is the canvas, which isn't what we have in nature. So when I see all you guys, you know, it's three-dimensional space. But I'm painting on a flat surface, so how am I going to take all this three-dimensionality and light and shadow and everything that's out there and put it on a flat surface and deal with the logic of it or how I actually do see it? Even things like how I look at things. In other words, I have a still life here on the table and I'm working on my easel here and I'm looking at the still life. And then I'm looking back at my painting, and then I'm looking back at do you actually think I'm getting my eye in the same place every time? I'm not. I may say, okay, I'm always gonna look at the top of the teapot, but that's not how it works. So he keeps seeing and understanding that there's more to looking than just basically looking, that it's a conceptual thing as well. So this sort of struggle in Cézanne, this objective, subjective, visual, cerebral, struggle, it is absolutely titanic in Cézanne. I mean, whatever we might get upset about, I don't know what it might be, politics, religion, whatever, that we really will go to the barricades for, he would go to the barricades for that. I mean, painting for him is a titanic struggle. It's angst-ridden. It's filled with trepidation, with failure. So you sense that very often in how his paintings actually look. So he's born in Aix-en-Provence in the south of France. His father was actually originally a hat maker, but then his father became part owner of a bank, became a banker. His father did make sure that his son got a very solid classical education. So Cézanne, despite liking to project himself as a kind of peasant from the country, was a very well-read intellectual individual. He was very proficient in Latin and in Greek. In fact, he won a number of contests as a student for his Latin. He grows up with another iconic, somebody who also grew up to be an iconic figure in French culture, and that's Émile Zola. They're childhood friends. They go to school together. They're from the same town. They hang out throughout all their childhood, teenage years, into their adulthood years, until later, eventually they have a falling out when Zola writes a novel called L'Œuvre. In English, we say, call it the masterpiece. And it's a novel in which he talks about a failed painter. He never mentions Cézanne. The painter's name is not Paul. But as soon as Cézanne read that novel, he thought that Zola was talking about him, that he had not lived up to his potential. And Cézanne never spoke to Zola again. That was essentially the end of the friendship over that novel. Of course, nobody's father, nobody's parents wants him to be an artist. And so that was true with Cézanne. His father wanted him to be a lawyer. Cézanne sort of toyed with the idea, but very clearly and very soon realized he wanted to really pursue an art career. And the best place to go for that was not to remain in the South, but to go to Paris. So in 1861, he takes his first trip to Paris. But it's really not Paris that is Cézanne's arena. It's Provence. So here is the Jardin Buffon, the family house, the House of the Winds. This is the actual house, the garden side. That was the family estate in Aix. This is an early painting of the house here. Actually, it's not so early. I think it's in the 1880s. Provence, not Paris, will remain the place that nurtures Cézanne, inspires him, where he's rooted. He will keep an apartment in Paris, and he will kind of shuttle back and forth until about the last 20 years or so, when he'll come back to Provence, and he'll never leave. He'll never leave again. In that sense, he's very much like the artist who was his idol, one of his idols. He had two real idols. One was Edouard Manet, and the other one was Gustave Courbet. And Courbet had remained in his sort of hometown of Ornans and kept going back to this provincial town because it sort of nurtured him. It was very much the same with Cézanne. Cézanne will paint everything about X, the people, the places, the mountains, the landscape, the local guys drinking, smoking at the bar, at the cafe that he goes to. He's not a great urban painter of Paris. He's not Degas in that particular regard. So, as I said, when he's starting to paint in Provence, he starts with portraits, in essence, because he can corral people, friends and family, to sit for him, and he doesn't have to pay them. And so some of these early great portraits from the 60s are all the people who were in his circle, friends, family, who were nice enough to put up with him, because, well, I'll come back to that later. He was horrible with models. So this is a painting we have here, the National Gallery. It's the portrait of Anthony Vallebrecq from 1866. And this is the same guy painted a different portrait. That's today at the Getty in Los Angeles, Anthony Vallebrecq, from about 3 years later, 69, so 66, 69 here. So early in his career, Cézanne is painting his friends, his relatives, anybody who's nice enough to sit for him in X. Anthony Vallebrecq was a close friend. He was close friends with Zola. They were all kind of school chums growing up. He was an art historian. Vallebrecq was an art historian. He was an essayist. He was a respected poet. So they were all very literary, intellectual sort of individuals. He sits several times for Cézanne. So there are several versions of portraits of Vallebrecq, not just these two. Ours is a magnificent, well, these are both magnificent, but here is this sort of standard three-quarter pose, face turned slightly, kind of traditional pose, this sort of plain, dark backdrop. That's all pretty conventional, but then you really look at how this thing is painted. The pose may be conventional, but there's nothing conventional about the paint application, because both of these paintings have this huge impasto, very thick, crusty, encrusted surfaces, very little in the sense of drawing. There are ragged contours everywhere. Paint just kind of bleeds into other paint. There's a lot of buildup of the pigment over the surface. Of course, here the tones, the colors are all earth tones. They're all darks, they're browns and blacks and earth tones. That's going to change eventually. These two paintings are painted almost exclusively with a palette knife. So not with a brush, but with a palette knife. So that sense of these lozenges and strata of paint that's been applied is pretty evident when you see it in the exhibition and look carefully. These are ferocious paintings. I mean, they're very aggressive, and they're very, very striking in their boldness and in that crudeness. He wants to look like that, because the artist he's emulating here, or most excited by, is Gustave Courbet, the great French realist. He's trying to sort of take up the mantle of Courbet. When you look at these hands, they're really not hands. They're like a couple of cudgels, like a couple of clubs of pigment. And the stance is rather kind of firm and maybe a little bit resistant in the sense of being a force, somebody who's not going to be pushed around by anybody. And I think that's certainly a certain autobiographical aspect of these early portraits when he's trying to assert his own personality. He felt pretty confident that when he submitted this to the 1866 Paris Salon, that it would be rejected, and he was right, it was rejected. But he felt very good, because that same year, paintings by both Manet and Renoir were also rejected. So he felt, okay, I'm in the right place now, because these are the guys I'm sort of interested in. One of the jurors for the Salon, when he looked at this picture by Cézanne, said that he thought it didn't look painted with a knife, but with a pistol. Here's a detail of the faces in both. Again, I mean, this is where you need to be in the galleries, but at the same time, I can show you these gigantic blow-ups that you can see in the gallery, and then you can sense other things. Of course, Vallebrecht, who was very supportive of Cézanne and tried to be very patient, nonetheless was appalled at how he came out in these pictures. And he wrote to Zola, and he said about the pictures, quote, "He has given me such a fierce complexion that it reminds me of the statue of Champfleury when it was stained with squashed blackberries." There's a public monument to Champfleury, bronze, and people used to throw fruit at it and stuff, and it would get all these splattered berries on its face. The Getty portrait on the right, that detail, again, is about 3 years later. Again, almost exclusively palette knife. Very thick paint, very deep successive layers of paint. Eventually, of course, as I said, this palette will lessen, and that will be directly related to when Cézanne begins to come into the circle of the Impressionists. But before that, staying in the 60s, this is his portrait of his father. This happens to be another painting that we're fortunate to own here. So the artist's father reading Le Venement from 1866 is the newspaper he's reading here. You can see the masthead. So Vallebrecht, other friends, his uncle Dominique sat for him, and then his father was willing to sit for him as well. Now this, Cézanne's relationship with his father was always fraught with tension, and there was tension throughout the entire relationship until his father actually died in 1886. He did give his son an allowance, a stipend, but he really had always expressed concern about his choice of a career, trying to become an artist instead of a lawyer or a banker, something that would be safer and you would earn more money. So there was this constant kind of, at times it's like a competition. Cézanne is, I don't know, all children try to please their parents. And at certain times you sense Cézanne is trying to get his father's approval even later in his life. So here he shows his father seated in this huge chair. It looks like almost like a throne for a pope or a king. He's in casual dress. He has his little reading cap on, his slippers. He's not really sitting back, but he's kind of perched forward. He's got huge, look at these hands again. I mean, they're just these big kind of like gorilla hands here. He's absorbed in his newspaper. There's a painting on the wall, still life, which is in fact the Cézanne still life. So he places himself in the painting, Cézanne does, with the still life. That's me. And I know you don't approve of this. So there's a kind of little discussion here that's going on. And that's further reinforced by the newspaper. This is not a newspaper his father would have ever read. It's a leftist paper. His father was very conservative. And not only is it a leftist paper, but it again inserts Cézanne into the equation insofar as this is the newspaper where all of Émile Zola's early reviews and essays about Manet and Cézanne appeared. They appeared in this newspaper. He is sort of saying, again, you know, Zola thinks I'm good and all this. He's still kind of dealing with that whole kind of somewhat difficult relationship. It's, again, it's a powerful, powerful painting. It has all the traits and techniques that we just mentioned in the Vallebrecht portraits here. And then we come to the still life. So here is the still life that's in the painting. Sugar bowl, pears, and blue cup. This is at the Musée d'Orsay today, from 1866. So again, the little framed Cézanne picture on the wall makes a pointed reference again to this relationship. He had started to paint still lifes as well as obviously friends who were available to him. And the still lifes were, like the portraits, were very in your face. I mean, this is an incredible piece of painting. There's a lusciousness almost to the way he puts the paint on. this sense again of it being sort of painted with a pistol instead of a brush. The one thing you notice, although there's a little more color here, is still they're relatively dark. So they owe a lot to really two earlier French still life painters, Courbet first and foremost, but even going back further to Chardin. Cézanne was aware of Chardin, had a great affection for him. The palette still is relatively dark, these browns and blacks and bitumens and siennas that he's using. Eventually it will be Pizarro who says to Cézanne, once they become friends, much like he said to Van Gogh, in essence, I'm paraphrasing, he said, lighten up. Van Gogh was painting in all these dark 17th century Dutch tonalities coming from Rembrandt, and then Van Gogh was, and then Cézanne was painting in these very dark Courbet-like colors, and so both of them took heed of what Pizarro would say to them. But the other thing about these pictures, about how the paint is applied here, Cézanne, at this point in his career, divided all of painting into two camps. One camp was that was what he would call the camp that paintings that had balls. They were ballsy, couillard in French, and everything else was emasculated. So those are the two camps. You either had to paint with balls, you had to be really aggressive, forceful, powerful, or everything else kind of fell flat, and that's something he would kind of continue to adhere to. Here's another great early one. This is the other great sitter who was very patient, like Vallebrec. This is his uncle, Uncle Dominique from 1866. So this is the portrait of detail. This is his maternal uncle. She was the brother of his mother. And he was very fond of his nephew and was very willing to sit for him. And not only to sit for him, but Cézanne would always have him dress up and wear something. This is actually an exception. Usually he had to wear a turban or a hat with a tassel, or he had to wear a monk's cowl. So we see him in all these different guises. The Met has two of these great paintings, one with the blue tasseled hat, and the other one is as a Dominican monk with a kind of a cowl. But they're all Uncle Dominique, and friends remarked that, quote, every day there appears a new portrait of him. Cézanne was cranking out these portraits of his uncle because his uncle was willing to sit for him so frequently. His uncle at this time was 49 years old. He was a bailiff, and again, quite supportive. Now, Cézanne had taken his first trip to Paris in 61, but that was a brief kind of excursion. It's in the decade of the 70s when he's now going to back and forth and spending more time in Paris that he begins to really become part of the circle of the Impressionists and some of these younger artists. So this is Cézanne here with Pizarro. And this is Cézanne with Pizarro. Once he meets the Impressionists, but more specifically Pizarro, things change. His style changes. Pizarro is a pivotal figure in the history of 19th century French art, and not just as a painter, but maybe more so as a teacher, as a mentor. And his two greatest projects, shall we say, were Vincent van Gogh and Paul Cézanne. For Cézanne, Pizarro was the father he never had. Pizarro was very supportive, nurturing, never, was always there if Cézanne needed anything. It's Pizarro who says, look, I like all the ballsy stuff, but let's lighten things up. Let's go outside. We're painting out in the open air using pure color. And the one thing he tells Cézanne is stop using black, bitumen, and burnt sienna. Just get rid of them, especially black. Get rid of black. None of us are using black. There was a very famous pigment dealer, art shop owner, who you probably know because he was painted repeatedly by Van Gogh, named Père Tanguy, who had a shop in Paris. You could go and buy pigments. Whenever anybody entered his shop and wanted to buy black, he would kick them out because they obviously weren't a serious avant-garde painter. So that was part of this sort of whole mystique at the time. Basically, Pizarro told Cézanne, just paint in the three primary colors, and their variations, red, yellow, blue. Don't worry about all the other darker stuff. Cézanne begins to paint and to go out into nature and to even spend time where Pizarro is, at Auvers, at Pontoise, and they go out and paint side by side very often. And again, Pizarro is important because at a certain point in Cézanne's career, for the most part, he simply gives up promoting his work. It's not selling, and I don't really have time. Plus, I'm not the best guy to go around and schmooze people. And so he just stopped promoting his work, which in the case of Cézanne, he does not have commercial success until he's in his 50s, when he starts to sell works. And that's mainly the influence of the dealer Ambrose Vollard, who will become very important in his life. I forgot to tell you about a quote when he, talking about his admiration for Courbet, but also Manet. He actually did meet Manet once, but it was very serendipitous, just on the street in Paris. He was walking down the street and he saw Manet coming up the other way. So he started thinking, I don't know, should I run? Should I go in the alley? should I approach him? Because he really, this was like a god almost. Of course, Manet was the man of the boulevard. I mean, he wore his top hat, he had his gloves, he had his walking stick. He wasn't really a kind of bohemian. And Cézanne looked like he had just been in the dung pit somewhere. So he comes up, they're about to meet, and Cézanne says to Manet, he says, sorry, I don't want to shake your hand. I haven't bathed in 3 days. And then he walked away. Then I wasn't like, well, let's talk about art. That was it. So you see the kind of guy we're dealing with here. This is one of the self-portraits in the exhibition, 1875 on the left. The painting on the right is not in the show, but it's by Pizarro. It's his self-portrait from 1873. Both of these today are in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. I think the portrait on the left, the self-portrait, is in some ways an homage to the self-portrait on the right. He's looking at his sort of teacher, mentor, friend, and he sees in him similar traits to himself. They're both shown in kind of working class garb as artists, long beards, prominent, sort of powerful figures. They're serious, they're professional. Cézanne was very instrumental in promoting this idea that an artist is a laborer, he's a worker. You gotta work every day. It's what I call today the lunch pail artist. I know artists who, you know, they get up at like 7 a.m, they pack their lunch, like they're going to the factory, and they go into the studio, and they're there until 8 p.m. It's their job. And it doesn't mean that you're inspired. Some days you're in your studio for 8 or 10 hours, and nothing's happened. So then you sharpen pencils, you know, you do things, you sweep, and then eventually something gets you to your easel or to your pad, that kind of thing. Cézanne was like that. And so that sense of the presence here of the artist is very important. He's in front of a picture here that is not a painting by Cézanne. It's by a close friend named Armand Guillaumin, and it's a portrait, not a portrait, it's a landscape of the Seine. Here's the Seine, there's the Notre Dame back there. But what's interesting in this painting, as we know this painting very well, is that the way Cézanne is showing it, it's reversed, which means that when he was painting his self-portrait, he was looking in a mirror. So the painting got reversed from the way it really is. Now, this relationship, you notice the similarity here, especially the figure types, the earthiness, the kind of clarity, the kind of presence in front of their art or art that they admire. All of that, and it is at this time that these two guys are actually literally going out and painting together side by side. So they're taking their easels, setting up right next to each other, and they're looking at the same motif. I don't know if you remember, I don't know, I think it's been a while now, 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years ago, there was a show at the Met. It was called Pizarro Cézanne. That was the title. And with that exhibition, you can still go online. I think they still have a lot of material up online. What they did for that exhibition, it was brilliant, brilliantly curated, is they found all of the pictures, not all, but many, where Cézanne and Pizarro had been together painting the same scene, and they had them next to each other. So in the show, you would see, here's what Cézanne, oh, his interpretation of that subject, and here was Pizarro's interpretation right next to each other. And it was really a fascinating show. On the left is Pizarro's painting, L'Invention, from 1871. And on the right is Cézanne, L'Invention after Pizarro. He copied this picture. This is Cézanne copying Pizarro here. So 1871 is Pizarro. 1872 on the right is Cézanne. Pizarro had fled to England during the Franco-Prussian War, as in fact also Monet had fled as well. He comes back after the war to France and settles in L'Invention and is painting there at the end of 1871-72. Cézanne in 1872 was visiting and working with Pizarro, and he saw this picture. And he thought it was so great that he asked Pizarro if he could take it for a while and make a copy. And that's the copy that he made. Of course, the Cézanne picture is really an intensification of a lot of what's going on in the Pizarro. The subtleties of the light and the shadow, that kind of stuff is less important. And if you really look at brushstrokes in the two pictures, for like every four brushstrokes by Pizarro, there's one by Cézanne, and it's a kind of a bolder kind of notation. This was L'Invention, and then Cézanne moves to be near Pizarro again, because Pizarro then resettles in Auvers, in the south of France. And in 1873, Cézanne moves to Auvers to be near, actually that's not in the south, it's up near Paris, to be near Pizarro and to work together, which they continue to do. Now, this choice of Auvers was interesting because there was somebody else who lived in Auvers that Pizarro knew, and that was Dr. Gachet. Dr. Gachet is painted twice by Vincent van Gogh, the great portraits of Gachet. And when Vincent was undergoing all of his various trepidations and mental problems, Theo had written to Gachet and said, if I send my brother to Auvers, you know, would you keep an eye on him because he's having trouble, he's been out of the asylum, blah, blah, blah. And Gachet was a great admirer of all these artists, so he said, sure, send him to Auvers. So he was kind of taking care of Van Gogh for a while. But I think what was going on with Cézanne and Pizarro is that Pizarro was hoping, Gachet was a collector, he was already beginning to buy works. And he was hoping that Gachet would buy paintings by Cézanne. That once he saw Cézanne's work, he would also start to buy some paintings. And in fact, he did. Again, not in the show, but this is our painting in the gallery. The House of Père Lacroix from 1873 by Cézanne. And on the right, Entrance to the Farm at Auvers, 1873. Here's where you begin to see things changing, of course, and that's that the palette changes. Now it's lighter and brighter, cleaner. He's still using a lot of the palette knife. He's really sort of blending foreground and middle ground are starting to really come forward onto the surface. And then everywhere in Cézanne, and what makes him different than the other Impressionists is then you start seeing structure and how he's trying to build, and things look like they're blocks almost that he's putting together in a very sort of specific way. So again, nonetheless, the palette, the open air painting, the sunlight, all that is coming to him by way of his relationship now with Pizarro and the other Impressionists. This is also the painting that he has the biggest signature ever. Cézanne doesn't always sign his paintings. Sometimes he signed them on the back, sometimes he didn't sign them at all. And this one has a really florid signature and date. And again, we think that was because he was hoping to sell this. And if it had his name prominently on it, if it went out, people would say, oh, that's a Cézanne, yeah. This is one of the great portraits in the show. It's small, but it's spectacular. And this is Cézanne's portrait of Victor Choquet from 1877. On the left is Renoir's portrait of Choquet from 1875. So again, Renoir, Cézanne. Choquet is very important figure for all of these guys. He worked in the Ministry of Finance. He wasn't particularly wealthy, but he was one of these guys who every extra dime he had, he saved in order to buy art, much to the chagrin of his wife, because there were times when they really had nothing and he was going out and buying a drawing or something. So he had met Degas in 1875, Choquet had. And then through Degas, he's introduced to Renoir. Renoir and Choquet are very, very close friends, very close. And Choquet is painted by Renoir on a number of occasions. He was, by 1876, Choquet is an avid supporter of Renoir, Monet, and also Cézanne. So he asks Cézanne if he would paint his portrait, and this is the result here. Very different. The Renoir is gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's light, dappled. It has almost a pointless technique. It has a softness about it. He sits in front of a Delacroix painting. One of the things that Choquet and Cézanne had in common was a love of Delacroix. Cézanne loved Delacroix. And the first time they met, in fact, the way they broke the ice was that Choquet said to Cézanne, "I understand you like Delacroix. Come and I'll show you." He already had a small collection of Delacroix paintings and drawings, so he showed them to Cézanne, and that kind of cemented this bond. And of course, Renoir had an equal fascination and love for Delacroix. But what a difference. This is all light and brushstroke and beautiful sort of subtlety. It's informal, this clasping of the hands. It's, of course, a much more personal, intimate, closer up kind of view of his friend. Cézanne sets Choquet into this chair, and he's literally locked into that painting between the bleeding off of all the frames. Here's his desk, as if he's just turned away from his desk. And it's all these big lozenges of paint and patterns in the carpet here. And then you see things, again, worthy of Degas. When you follow this leg in the back of the chair, and then you find the frames, it's a way of putting him in a place. Degas does this. Nobody does that better than Degas. But Cézanne's aware of that. But then you look at the face, and it's not in the hands. And it's not, again, about just a lovely kind of eminence, almost. That's the Renoir. Renoir almost emanates light, but it's a very different kind of structured approach. It's a small painting, so you have to go to the gallery, go to the show to see it. It's not anywhere near as big as what you see here. And yet it has great sort of power. There are many, I've just sort of mentioned Ambroise Vollard in passing. We're going to talk a little bit more about him in a few minutes. But Vollard he wrote a little book that I highly recommend to you. It's just called Cézanne. It's in paperback. Although we don't have it at our bookstore, I think it might be out of print, but you could get a used copy. It's an anecdotal kind of book talking about his relationship with Cézanne and working together and when he sits for him as a portrait. I'll show you that in a second. And he tells a great story about Choquet here. And how he had become so obsessed with trying to collect art, even though he wasn't a particularly wealthy individual. And his wife was very, very much against this because she wanted to spend money like on food and things like that. So there's one story that's great where Choquet decides to buy a Cézanne, and he buys a little bather's picture. It's very small. And he's afraid to take it home. So he tells a friend, he said, "Look, I'm going to give you this painting. You come over for a visit, and you tell me that you just bought it. And then I'm going to go from there." So the friend takes the painting, comes over, knocks on the door, comes in. He's got this little Cézanne, and which Choquet has purchased. And Choquet says, "Wow, what a beautiful painting, a Cézanne." And then he says, "Honey, come here. You've got to see this picture." Yeah, you know, that he just bought. "Look at this. Isn't it wonderful?" And then he had told his friend, "Make sure when you leave, you forget to take it with you." So they're waxing, you know, his wife is, "Yeah, it's nice." And then the friend, as he was instructed, leaves, acting as if he's forgotten the painting. And then days and weeks go by and showcase, and when are you going to come back and pick up his picture and everything, I guess. And then ultimately, the painting starts, because Choquet is constantly raving about it, it starts to grow on his wife, and then eventually he breaks the news to her that, in fact, we own this painting. So that kind of mechanism, that kind of machinations. There are some powerhouse paintings in the exhibition. They're quintessential, iconic Cezannes. This is one of them on the left, the portrait of his wife, Hortense Viquet, from 1877. We have, the exhibition is wonderful with her portraits because we have tableaus of three or four or five together that show you changes and approaches. She is his most frequent model. She poses throughout their entire life together. She suffers greatly at his hands in terms of being a model, and a wife for that matter. This is the portrait that's in Boston, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Cezanne required an incredible number of sittings. Cezanne's relationship with models, even models who were his friends or family, like his wife, is notorious. Professional models, the word went out pretty quickly. You don't want to work for this guy. I mean, you have to be there 8 or 9 hours. He doesn't even give you a bathroom break. And if you twitch, he'll tear up the painting and kick you out. You know, it's like a torture. One of the great things, we talk about the invention of photography in 1839 and how different artists use photography. Degas used photography, Renoir used photography. It was good for Cezanne, because what he could do once he got a camera was to take a picture of a model. And then he could pin up the picture on his easel, and she's not going to move because it's a photograph. Plus, he doesn't have to pay anybody. He was notoriously cheap in terms of what he paid models. Madame Cezanne sits for at least roughly 30 times for 30 portraits of her. So she was his most frequent model. He demands incredible patience, and she was able to do it. He's a very slow, painstaking painter. I'll say more about that when we look at his portrait of Vollard. The thing about Cezanne, and I think this is a painting where, for me, it kind of comes to the fore. I said that Cezanne is sort of difficult, complicated, and he is all of that. As an art historian, I find it very difficult to talk about Cezanne, only because I find it very difficult to... I don't think I have the ability to really convey to an audience why he's so great. I know he's great, and I know these paintings are great, and there are certain paintings that I know this is a really great painting, and yet if I have to try to really explain it to somebody, I have difficulty myself, because there's just something about, I'm better even with Picasso. With Cezanne, there's just something about the painting that my God, this is a phenomenal painting. And then you can try, I can get in there and do my little formal thing and this, that, and the other stuff, but still, you're not doing justice. So that's how I feel about this picture on the left. It's magnificent, and it's all based on so many ideas that Cezanne was dealing with. Certainly this tension about holding forms on the two-dimensional picture plane. You notice she wears this particular dress that is essentially cool, it's a cool color, this blue. But she's in a red chair, which is a hot color. Normally, blue or green will go away from our eye, and hot colors, red or yellow or orange, will advance towards our eye. She's in front of the advancing color. So the blue color is pushing her back, but the red chair is advancing. And so there's this, especially in this part of the picture, where she kind of morphs into the chair here, there's a great, great tension here. There's a great, great desire to explore these relationships. This is fantastic. This pattern, this kind of prison bar sort of pattern across the front of the plane, and where the lap is in relationship to creating depth and also surface. Then you kind of, a microcosm of all of this is the face here, where it's built up in this kind of blocky, very, very logical way with these thick slabs of paint. You can see why you can't have Picasso and you can't have Matisse without this. Matisse's portrait of the woman with the green stripe. I mean, all of that. Matisse's portrait of the woman with the green stripe, all of that is coming back here to Cézanne. Again, we're very fortunate we own this picture, Boy in a Red Waistcoat from 1888. And I'm comparing it to another painting we own at the gallery, which is probably an inspiration, and it's a Florentine Mannerist painting from the 16th century, portrait of Ugolino Martelli. We don't know the artist, just that he's Florentine, on the right from 1550. This is another painting that is a stupefying painting. Where you sit and try to sort of decode it and deconstruct it. Clearly, these paintings are arrangements of shapes and colors, but you have to figure out the spatial relationships of where the chair to the wall is. He's wearing these sort of chaps. At one point, though, it looks like almost a curtain is engulfing him here. Incredibly long arm here. So that, again, there's very often these passages where Cézanne, if you look carefully, again, he's reminding you that this is a painting. I mean, I'm looking at something, but it's also just a painting. Cézanne has to work like Van Gogh did, what we call sur le motif. He has to be looking at the motif. So there's got to be something in front of him. There has to be a model, there has to be an apple, there has to be a mountain. He's got to be looking at something. Van Gogh was the same way. Gauguin was not. Gauguin hated that kind of idea. And of course, that was a rift between Gauguin and Van Gogh, was when Gauguin is constantly telling Van Gogh, just use your imagination. You don't have to keep looking at things. You know, just make up stuff. And Van Gogh would have a seizure when he was told that. So again, certainly the pose owes something. Cézanne is an incredible student of art history. He spent hours and hours and years in the Louvre doing sketches. I mean, Titian, Rubens, the Mannerists, you name it. He has filled sketchbooks with their art. So this kind of cocked contrapposto pose, kind of slightly sort of effeminate pose, is again clearly coming to him from Mannerist pictures. This exhibition is portraits, it's not still lifes, but I can't talk about Cézanne without talking about some of the greatest pictures, which are certainly the apples. What I think is going on with the apples, by the way, and you can kind of sense it here. So this is apples from 1877. This is apples from 1878. And this is a drawing that's in Cincinnati, the Art Museum, self-portrait in apple. So it is a portrait from 1880 to 84. It's a pencil sketch. I think what's going on with the apples and still lifes in general is that eventually Cézanne just gives up on people. You know, everybody's moving and shifting and yawning. They need to go to the bathroom. They need to have lunch. How can you work with these people? So he just says, I'd rather paint an apple. Because when he paints his apples, especially the apples, we know he went to great pains. He had little coins that he would stick under the apple or a little wedge of wood to raise it up a bit. You know, so then it was good. It was fixed. And he could sort of go to town with it as long as he wanted to. The apples are among the greatest paintings in Western art history, Cézanne's apples. Every stroke in the apple is an assertion of his sort of will, his talent. These incredible brush strokes, these parallel strokes, painted in reserve where things bleed open, the point of view, close up a little bit farther away, up looking down, down looking up, all of these different things. The more you look at the apples, the more he seems to be asserting to you that I'm these apples. That's what I think is happening here. His head is next to an apple. He thinks of himself as an apple or an apple as himself. I mean, there's that tight kind of connection, I think, in that drawing. Again, I'll go quickly here because we're not looking at still lifes in the show, but his still lifes are among the most revolutionary paintings, especially because he begins to explore on that flat surface this whole idea of multiple viewpoints and simultaneity. So this is a very famous drawing by an artist who wrote a very famous book in the 20s about Cézanne's still lifes, in which he diagrams number 1, 1A, 2 here, where you would have to be to see all these different views. So you'd have to be down below, looking up, on the right, looking left, high up, looking down. So here we see the ginger pot in. Here we're at eye level. Here he shows you the table here. But by the time we get over here, it's flat here. I mean, these are the paintings you can sit for an hour in front of easily and try to say, okay. And we know that not only was Cézanne painting the still life and dealing with this idea I mentioned to you before about how you really don't get your eye back in the same place each time. So I might see this little guy differently each time. But he also, we know with his still lifes, he would then pick up his easel and move. So he'd have his still life set up, and I'm starting here. But then I just pick it up, and I put it here, and now I see the table a little bit differently as he would circulate. The other thing you see here are these relationships. Cézanne is magnificent because, as he said at one point, everything together, when you put a bunch of stuff together, everything is affecting everything else. So if I've just got one thing on the table, okay, that's fine. If I put two things, three things, four things, they start to affect each other. So very often, you'll see in a Cézanne painting a little teapot or a sugar bowl or something that's kind of leaning towards the apple or something. It's almost as if I'd like to get to know that apple. I'd like to kind of understand that apple. And so you have these little relationships. Well, he'll curve something and then curve something to give it a little place. There's a great Mont Saint Victoire painting that's at the Courtauld that shows this dip in the mountain. And right above that, he's showing you a pine tree that just dips to echo that same dip. And yet they're in two different planes. They're in two different planes. So here we're looking eye level, down, things are tilted. These are two more examples here. I mean, again, I don't need to say much that hasn't already been said. We're high above looking down here, eye level here. Notice he shows you a bottle. It breaks here, but differently on this side, where it starts to break, right, and curve. The Madeleines here, the flatness of the table, the edge of the table. What the heck's happening here? Where is this guy resting? Where is he situated in relationship to the way this all of a sudden becomes a two-dimensional sort of fabric fold? We have two great still lifes. Well, we have more than two, but these are two of the best that we have, the peppermint bottle, and then this still life here at the National Gallery. This is a remarkable painting because, again, the little break and linear element in the carafe is picked up by the wall. These are supposed to be in front of the wall, but at times you're not sure if something is in front of the wall or attached to the wall. The peppermint bottle breaks here, but differently on this end here. Again, very precarious, this little guy. How the heck is that guy there? If a carafe is round, how's that little apple sitting back there, right? Here. This is very important. Notice back here, it's covered, right? This is what I call showing a little leg. This is very important because when he lifts the tablecloth here, he allows you to see the edge of the table. Without that, it's different. And once you see the edge of the table, then you're going to just instinctively follow it across. And now this is all flat here. When you see these napkins, when you visit Cézanne's studio in Le Louvre, where everything is just the way he left it for the most part, and you see where he used to set up his still lifes, it's in front of a big window, and he would look out, and what he was looking out at very often was Mont Saint Victoire, the big mountain that he was obsessed with. And so there's times when he's painting these draperies. This is especially the case, I think, here, where I think he's painting the drapery, and then he's looking out. Well, I don't know, the drapery kind of looks like a mountain, and it becomes a little notation for the mountain as well. These are magnificent, difficult, tremendous paintings. These are the paintings that obsessed Picasso and Braque when they looked at these still lifes. They started to understand what Cézanne was about. We have a wonderful grouping of these pictures in the apartment of Madame Cézanne. This is the one that's at the Met, which is probably the greatest of the grouping. incredible complexity here. Here she is in the Paris apartment that she's painted in here, wearing this shawl collared sort of red dress. All of the things that are happening here, and playing with all of the traditional ideas of painting, perspective, linear perspective, recession, light, color, modeling in light and shadow, all of these things he's toying with and changing and pushing or eliminating, so that it just becomes incredibly powerful in its way that we try to understand what's going through this guy's mind. The card players can often be considered portraits because they're essentially the guys he knew in the bar in X. These are his friends and workers and pipe smokers and cigarette smokers, etc. I want to show you, though, this. This is Ambrose Vollard in front of his Picasso, one of his Picassos. There are two great art dealers in France in this period. The earlier one is Durand Ruel. Durand Ruel is the great supporter of the Impressionists. He buys something like 5,000 Impressionist paintings. So he supports Renoir, Monet, Pizarro, Sisley, everybody, Cassatt, Bert Morisot. And a few years ago, there was a big Durand Ruel show. There was an exhibition in Philadelphia about him as a collector and all the artists. And not long ago, there was a show about him at the Met on Vollard in the same way. His impact on the history of art, collecting all these guys, and he was supporting the next generation, Cézanne, especially Cézanne, and then especially Picasso. He's associated especially with the young Picasso. So this is Cézanne's portrait of Vollard that's in the exhibition. And here he is in real life in front of one of his Picassos here. It's a great painting, but this is the painting where if you go to Vollard's little book on Cézanne, there is an entire chapter said that's titled Cézanne Paints My Portrait. And it's about the sittings here and all the things that happen. Vollard asks Cézanne to paint his portrait, and Cézanne says, yeah, okay. So, you know, come tomorrow at such and such a time. And when he comes, Cézanne has set up this rickety, there's like a table that's really rickety. And then he puts a packing crate on that, and then a little stool on top of that. And he tells Vollard, you're going to sit up there. And Vollard is like, really, you got to be kidding. And say, nah, don't worry, it'll be fine, you'll be fine. So he gets up there. And for this painting, Vollard sat 115 times. 115 times he sat for this picture. And the sitting started at 8 o'clock in the morning and ended at 11:30 in the morning, with almost no time off to go to the bathroom, to have a little bite to eat. 11:30 is just before lunch. No snacking. So 115 times. And eventually, Cézanne abandoned this painting. He considers it unfinished. And when Vollard said, well, wait a minute, I don't know, it looks pretty good to me, the famous line by Cézanne was, I am not displeased with the shirt front. He thought the only part of this painting worth saving was this part, right here. So again, this is a friend. Working with models was horrific. If you were a model working for Cézanne, it was absolutely horrific. Now let me show you something else. Here are three portraits of Vollard. Renoir, Cézanne, Picasso. So when we say that without Cézanne, there would not be cubism, this is kind of like what we're talking about here. This is the transitional picture from Impressionism. This is a beautiful painting by Renoir, but this is a much tougher painting, and this is tougher still, but you can't have this without having first seen that. Cézanne finally comes back to Provence. He settles for good in his later years. He buys a little plot of land. His father dies in 86. His mother dies in 97. So he gets an inheritance that he has to split just with his sister. He takes his inheritance and he buys an acre of land in Provence near Mont-Saint-Victoire, this mountain. He builds a house and a studio that you can still visit today. Here he is coming out of it. in 1906. He's moved in by September of 1902. I'm just showing you. He has visitors. This is a photograph of Cézanne by the painter Émile Bernard. Bernard came to visit frequently. So this is a photograph of from 1904 showing Cézanne in front of the bathers. That's today at the Barnes Foundation. So this is the Barnes bathers there. Of course, this is the mountain he's obsessed with. Down here is where he's living. Here are the specific places and locations. This is one of the great, maybe the greatest of the Mont Saint Victoire paintings. This is the one in Philadelphia from 1902 to 1904. Bernard was with him when he was going out every day to paint, and Bernard said, quote, Cézanne picked up a box in the hall of his studio and took me to his motif. It was 2 kilometers away with a view over a valley of the at the foot of Saint Victoire, the craggy mountain which he never ceased to paint. He was filled with admiration for this mountain. This painting is a war in terms of an artist trying to understand nature that he sees and yet having to translate it onto this canvas. And here he is at work. He's in his declining years. This is 1906, this is the year of his death. Look at this. This is the brushwork at the top of Mont Saint Victoire, the Philadelphia picture. This is the middle ground of the painting. By Cézanne's death, and even before his death, you already have people like Bernard who are coming to pay tribute to him. They're visiting him. They're talking to him. This is Maurice Denis' painting called Hommage to Cézanne from 1900. It shows a group of young painters gathered around the still life by Cézanne, which is this still life on the right. That's today at MoMA, Fruit Bowl, Glass and Apples from 1879. So we have a whole group of painters here. We have Odion Raydon. This is Raydon. Here we have Paul Cerisier, Edward Vuillard, Maurice Denis, Pierre Bonnard. They're all here paying tribute to Cézanne, who is represented by the painting, of course. That's Cézanne present. You may know that great painting by Fantin Latour of Manet in his studio at his easel, surrounded by all these younger artists who were coming to visit him. Monet is in the painting, Renoir is in the painting, Fantin Latour, Basile. They're all sort of standing around watching Manet paint. This is a kind of similar thing. This is one of the great late portraits. So this is in the show, along with a couple of other variations. But this is the one we own at the National Gallery. Here, this is the Gardner Valier from 1906. Lots written about this picture. It has a lot of stuff going on biographically and materially. This is his gardener down in X. The man that he was very close to was his gardener, worked for him right up till the end of his life. He paints him on a number of different occasions, but this painting is particularly rough and tough. Take this to the lab and look at it. It's got all kinds of, it looks like it has hundreds, literally hundreds of alterations, where he's put the paint on, scraped it off, put it back on, and where it gets, looks very ragged. There's almost no drawing or underdrawing, but it's extensively reworked. It's a painting, one of those paintings that he seems unable to have let go of. And this is not unusual for artists in their last years to feel like, you know, if I finish this picture, I'm going to die. So I got to make sure I still want to sort of deal with it. Or it could be like, you know, Mahler, I'm not going to write 10 symphonies because, I mean, I got to get through 9 because everybody dies at 9. So I've got to write 10th, that kind of stuff. So there's little characterization to the face. He's got his hat pulled down. It's very rough. A strange position of the hands. He's not holding anything, but it looks like he could be holding a pipe or something maybe, but there is nothing in his hands. When people came to see Cézanne, and this was on his easel in his studio right up to the time of his death, one person relates that he said to him, quote, talking about this picture, Cézanne said, if I succeed with this fellow, it will mean that the theory was correct. And what we know there is that Cézanne was planning to try to write some kind of a treatise on painting. That never happened, and I'm not sure he would have been able to write it anyway. I don't think he was that kind of an artist. but he seemed to think that this picture was going to encapsulate a lot of his views about the nature of painting. Now, in October of 1906, he was out painting outside, as he always did every day, no matter how he felt. And he was caught in a thunderstorm in which there was an incredible kind of deluge of rain. Instead of going in right away, he continued to work in the rain for 2 hours. And it was just like pouring out in this field. Then he finally decided to go home. But on the way home, he collapsed in the road. A man coming by who was driving a cart found him in the road and picked him up, knew who he was, and took him to the house. His housekeeper, he was like a piece of ice. He was freezing. And so his housekeeper tried to sort of get circulation back. He regained consciousness. And then the next day he went back out and worked. Instead of resting, staying warm for a day or two, he actually went back out to work the next day. And while he was painting, he fainted on this next day. They called for the doctor. He was put to bed. This time he never left his bed. And he died a few days later. He died on October 22nd, 1906. He was 67 years old, and he died of pneumonia. So here he is. This is a Bernard photograph. So this is a little earlier, 1904. Here's the studio today. I'm sure many of you have been there. Everything is left, all the things he used, all the little pots and sugar bowls, and here's a still life table. Right here, looking out towards Mont-Saint-Victoire. He dies in 1906, and in 1907, at the Salon d'Automne, in the Autumn Salon in Paris, they hold the first major retrospective of his work, 1907. This is a pivotal date in art history. Every young Parisian artist, and even those who weren't in Paris but made pilgrimages to come to Paris, goes to that exhibition, most especially the young Picasso. What painting does Picasso paint in 1907? The Demoiselle d'Avignon. And the two central bathers in that picture are bathers that come out of Cézanne's bathing pictures. This is not the 1907 retrospective. This is a show just to show you how these things looked at the time. This is the Salon, the Autumn Salon in Paris, but it's 1904 when Cézanne is still alive. And this area is devoted to Cézanne. This is this picture, one of the smokers, the pipe smokers. This is not in the show though. This is the one that's in the Hermitage in Russia. We have another one that's in the exhibition. This is Choquet, remember him? That's in Columbus today. These are bather pictures. Same exhibition, different space. This is the portrait of Madame Cézanne in the green hat. Today, this is in the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia. This still life is here. In 2005, this still life came up for auction at Christie's, and it sold for, let me get the right price. What did it sell for? Keeping you waiting, of course, this is the drama. $10,320,000. This picture here, that's right there. This is Cézanne. On the left, Bibi Musquari from 1895. If you saw our Cézanne and Provence show, we had this picture in that exhibition. This is Georges Braque, the cubist. Here, called the Viaduct at Lestac from 1908. Cézanne said at one point, quote, I point the way, others will come after. And indeed they did. So Picasso regards his famous quote about Cézanne is that he was, quote, a mother hovering over us. Matisse regards Cézanne, quote, as the father to us all. One of the other great British critics, in addition to Roger Fry, was Clive Bell, part of the Bloomsbury group, as was Fry. And he says in 1922 about Cézanne, he says, quote, it is true that there is hardly one modern artist of importance to whom Cézanne is not father or grandfather, and that no other influence is comparable with his. Here is Cézanne's portrait of the painting of the Gardin that we have at the National Gallery That actually belongs to the White House, though, but we get to hang it here. 1890, this is Picasso. The houses on the hill at Horta d'Ebro from 1909. Picasso was interviewed about Cézanne on a number of occasions. And in the 20s, during an interview, he said this, and there's a line in here that I think is just perfect. He said about Cézanne, quote, "It's not what the artist does that counts, but what he is. Cézanne would never have interested me a bit if he had lived and thought like Jacques-Émile Blanche." Blanche was a famous still life painter of apples. "Even if the apple he painted had been 10 times as beautiful, what forces our attention is Cézanne's anxiety." That's Cézanne's lesson. And there you have to be a painter. Cézanne is an artist of anxiety. He's constantly problem solving. He's not happy, he's failing, he's not living up to what he wants. 115 sittings, I like the shirt. This kind of thing. He dies, as I said, on October 23rd. Then this retrospective had 56 of his paintings, which then becomes a touchstone for how many young artists come to that exhibition and go away just absolutely sort of changed forever. Matisse and Picasso most especially. Thank you, everybody.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.